Well, of the many mistakes and stupid things that I have done as a priest that are well recorded in my memory, the one that I particularly associate with Easter mornings is this. A couple of times over the years, I have slipped in a sarcastic or snarky comment about church attendance this day as compared to other Sundays. Very unoriginal clergy barb about seeing ears, Christmas and Easter worshipers only. And, may have tried to mask an acerbic tone under some humor in those occasions. But I'm being very serious with you. I regret those comments, and I'm not going to do that anymore. And this is not a setup for anything. But I'm glad y'all have a sense of humor anyway. No, seriously, a chiding spirit, however cleverly delivered, is just not the spirit that I want to convey on behalf of the church this day and for these times. For whether you are a Christmas and Easter attendee today or an every Sunday regular, you've chosen the best possible day to come. And the fact is, this room is filled not because we've got all these people here who rarely attend except on Easter or Christmas. No, that's not really it. It is that all of us who come sometimes, but hardly every Sunday, are all here at the same time, on the same day. And so what we have here now is a vision of St. George's at her very best. The way we want it to be, the way we know it can be. And each and every one of you is equally important to that vision. So it is just beautiful to see. And I want to say how much I appreciate that and thank every one of you for coming to worship today. It may be that such a vision as this, so many people coming together around one central unifying event or truth in community, is itself a kind of Easter miracle for our day and age, not to be overlooked, not to be taken lightly. Of course, I think one has to have their head in the sand not to be aware of massive cultural fragmentation in our day. It's affecting all of our major institutions, from politics to the academy, to the arts and entertainment, to religion, to many communities. And like many of you, I have an ever-expanding section of my personal library, an ever-expanding section in my file cabinets, is filling up with books and articles and studies and essays describing this precarious historical moment in which we're living. And even if keen cultural observers and careful historians don't always agree about the underlying reasons or prudent responses, there really is no argument anymore about our situation. There is a deep sense that we are living at the end of something. Maybe the final chapter of an historical epic that began roughly 500 years ago or so and includes like the Protestant Reformation, the Enlightenment, the Scientific Revolution. And certainly, and I think inarguably, one of the great and unexpected ironies of our late modern situation is this. Despite the incredible material and technological advances of the last few centuries, a catalog of advances that grows exponentially with each new decade, despite such perceived progress, today's Western civilization is characterized by widespread breakdown of social cohesion at every single level, a loss of meaning among so many, the erosion of community, rampant individualism, and increased material comfort have not led to greater happiness in our day, but they have led to greater loneliness, isolation, and despair, and hopelessness. Commentator Andrew Sullivan wrote in an article recently in the New York Magazine, an essay entitled, "The World is Better Than Ever. Why Are We Miserable?" And it is on this great paradox, perhaps the tragedy at the center of modern life. We are prosperous and free and comfortable and unhappy. Sullivan argues we don't actually realize how eccentric our times are compared to the rest of all of human history, the 95% that comes before us. We're living utterly differently from the vast majority, again, of our forebears in history, mainly in this loss of community and around shared notions of human personhood and around God. Sullivan writes, "We have no common concept of human flourishing apart from materialism, and therefore we stand alone. It is perfectly possible that this strange diversion in human history, a few centuries at most compared with 200 millennia, is a massive error that will at some point be mercilessly corrected. Humans have never lived before without a faith or cult or set of practices designed to reconcile us to death and suffering. Why should this situation continue forever?" End quote. Of course, it need not continue forever, and I believe it will not. And we are the one community here, the church, who are to live witnessing to our fractured world what it is to be reconciled to death and suffering, and reconciled to God, and reconciled to one another. And that is why we need everybody here that we can possibly get on a day like today. So one might say that the question that addresses us on Easter actually speaks from the murky depths of the Old Testament. The question, "So, mortal, what do you think? Can these bones live?" Some of you will immediately recognize that line from the most famous passage in the book of Ezekiel, and the most famous story in that book, the Valley of Dry Bones. At a time of profound crisis and disorientation and disillusion for Israel, captivity and exile and Babylon in the 6th century BC, God issues a powerful vision for the prophet Ezekiel. "The hand of the Lord came upon me, and he brought me out by the Spirit of the Lord and set me down in the middle of a valley, and it was full of bones, and he led me all around them." These are human bones, what's left of what once was a people. God asks him, as I believe God asks us, "So what do you think? Can these bones live? Can the dead live again?" And the Spirit of the Lord blew over those bones, and they reassembled, and they came to life as a new people. Centuries before that first Easter morning, the vision was given. The promise was given to Israel, a people thought to be over and done with. A vision given to the church in today's world, perhaps thought by many to be over and done with too. No. No. There is more. There will be more than this. There is more than dry bones. There is life, and there is hope, and there is a new future, and God will do it because only God can do it. And of course, on this day, this glorious morning, we celebrate the way that God does it, the resurrection of the crucified Jesus. And so I intentionally pair that old story from Ezekiel, from the Old Testament, with the resurrection story in Mark that we hear today for a very simple reason. In addition to being so obviously linked prophetically, they are each strange and disconcerting and unsettling. Wait a minute. Skeletal bones are for Halloween. Bunnies and bonnets are for Easter. Fear and terror are for horror films. Joy and hugs are for the empty tomb. Not really. How incongruous is the way we celebrate Easter here today with the actual story in Mark's gospel? The women come to the tomb early this morning, and let's just say it's not at all what they were expecting. They were expecting dry bones, so to speak, a dead corpse. But encountering an angel who informs them that Jesus has been raised, they fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. What do you think we're supposed to get from this scene? What are we to learn from the described experience of these women at the empty tomb? The women, far from seeing what has happened and deciding to kneel down in worshipful reverie, bathe in the light of the new rising sun, far from raising their arms and praising God with alleluias, or far from sounding like so many in our own cultural context, whew, what a relief. We thought he was dead. Good news. Yeah. No, the women demonstrate a growing sense of alarm. Just interrupting myself here. Last night, I get home after the Easter vigil, and sharing, got to get up early again and go back to church, and sharing with family, actually, that I'm usually, when I preach, especially the first one here on Sunday mornings, and it's always different getting here early on Easter Sunday. So I pull in the parking lot this morning before the sun comes up and get out of my car, and it's just beginning to see a little hint of light just before 6 a.m., and I hear the birds. And every year as I walk across the parking lot into the building, I'm thinking about those women. This is what it was like. This is what they were hearing. It's just beautiful and peaceful, and I'm alone, and I'm thinking about this day. And this morning, right then, an ambulance goes tearing down Harding Road, blaring siren. And I thought, that's what it was like. That's what it's like, actually. I believe Mark quite deliberately wants us to feel something like that, something like what those women experienced. His announcement of the risen Jesus is not a tidy ending to the story, but an unsettling new beginning. What does this mean for the women, for you, for me, for this world? And the longer that I do pastoral ministry in this place, the more I wish we might experience something of the fear of the empty tomb. Fear, that is, that all of our ideas about the way our lives should go and how the world ought to deal with us fairly might be overturned in one stunning revelation. What we thought about life, what we thought about our place in the world, what we thought about our goals and our dreams, what we work for so hard, all of it a pile of beans compared to this. Oh my God. Oh my God. They fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And it is not just that Jesus passed away and then he was miraculously resuscitated. It is that Jesus was crucified on the cross and then raised. That makes all the difference. The resurrection is not overcoming a mistake. You know, Jesus should never have been executed in the first place. No, the resurrection is a vindication of a sacrifice once offered for our sake. A vindication of a way of being and living and